Good morning, Prince George. This is the 4th of September and Uncle Don's first Wednesday show. I hope that some of you are listening or not tuned in by accident. I intend to follow this with regular Wednesday presentations of my rantings with the title of Uncle Don Reads the Comics until my old carcass fails me.
All right, turn up. You think 2 plus 6 at least. Keep talking.
Okay. For those of you who have not heard the tale behind this title, here it is. In the 1940s, there was a popular radio show in which Uncle Don read the comics, Sunday comics, to the kids in the New York area. He led them through the various comic strips panel by panel, explaining the situations in dialogue. One Sunday, when he incorrectly thought that he was off air, he made the comment to his control room, "I guess that will take care of the little bastards for another week." End of Uncle Don. He's a hero of mine. This is CFUR Radio, broadcasting at 88.7 FM and on cable at 101.5 in Prince George. The following preview is approved for all audiences. Next week, I will be devoting my show to commentary on certain events which occurred in the territory of our southern neighbor a year ago. I will not be in step with other commentaries you will hear that day. I have my own view of that day last September and subsequent events. You may have suspected that. Wednesday, 11 September, 11:30 a.m. Be here. Logic of Empire. I'm going to start with a serious subject that I hope you will follow and give some thought to. If you haven't the patience or intellect to follow this, I suggest that you rush right off to bingo or go shopping for something useless. Bye-bye. Following is an editorial from the point of view of the British, but it could just as well have been written with few modifications by a thoughtful Canadian. You can find it in most libraries on page 11 of the Guardian Weekly of 15 August. Georges Monbiot has written the piece entitled The Logic of Empire. Quote, "There's something almost comical about the prospect of George Bush waging war on a nation because that nation has defied international law. Since Bush came to office, the United States government has torn up more international treaties and disregarded more United Nations conventions than the rest of the world has in 20 years. It has scuppered the Biological Weapons Convention while experimenting illegally with biological weapons of its own. It has refused to grant chemical weapons inspectors full access to its laboratories and has destroyed attempts to launch chemical inspections in Iraq. It has ripped up the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty and appears to be ready to violate the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. It has permitted CIA hit squads to recommence covert operations of the kind that included, in the past, the assassination of foreign heads of state. It has sabotaged the Small Arms Treaty, undermined the International Criminal Court, refused to sign the Climate Change Protocol, and, last month, sought to immobilize the UN Convention Against Torture so that it could keep foreign observers out of its prison camp on Guantanamo Bay. Even its preparedness to go to war with Iraq without a mandate from the UN Security Council is a defiance of international law far graver than Saddam Hussein's noncompliance with UN weapons inspectors. But the U.S. government's declaration of impending war has, in truth, nothing to do with weapons inspections. The U.S. government's justification for whooping Saddam has now changed twice. At first, Iraq was named as a potential target because it was assisting al-Qaeda. This turned out to be untrue. Then the U.S. government claimed that Iraq had to be attacked because it could be developing weapons of mass destruction and was refusing to allow the weapons inspectors to find out if this were so. Now, as the promised evidence has failed to materialize, the weapons issue has been dropped. The new reason for war is Saddam Hussein's very existence. This, at least, has the advantage of being verifiable. It should surely be obvious by now that the decision to wage war on Iraq came first and the justification later. Other than the age-old issue of oil supply, this is a war without strategic purpose. The U.S. government is not afraid of Saddam Hussein, however hard it tries to scare its own people. There is no evidence that Iraq is sponsoring terrorism against America. Saddam is well aware that if he attacks another nation with weapons of mass destruction, he can expect to be nuked. He presents no more of a threat to the world than he has done for the past 10 years. But the U.S. government has several pressing domestic reasons for going to war. The first is that attacking Iraq gives the impression that the flagging war on terror is going somewhere. The second is that the people of an all-super-dominant nations love war. As Bush found in Afghanistan, whacking foreigners wins votes. Allied to this concern is the need to distract attention from the financial scandals in which both the president and vice president are enmeshed. Already, in this respect, the impending war seems to be working rather well. The U.S. also possesses a vast military-industrial complex that is in constant need of conflict in order to justify its staggeringly expensive existence. Perhaps more importantly than any of these factors, the hawks who control the White House perceive that perpetual war results in perpetual demand for their services. If the U.S. were not preparing to attack Iraq, it would be preparing to attack another nation. The U.S. will go to war with that country because it needs a country with which to go to war. Tony Blair also has several pressing reasons for supporting an invasion. By appeasing Bush, he placates Britain's right-wing press. Standing on Bush's shoulders, he can assert a claim to global leadership more credible than that of other European leaders, while defending Britain's anomalous position as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. Within Europe, his relationship with the president grants him the eminent role of broker and interpreter of power. By invoking the special relationship, Blair also avoids the greatest challenge any prime minister has faced since the Second World War. This challenge is to recognize and act upon the conclusion of any objective analysis of global power, namely that the greatest threat to world peace is not Saddam Hussein but George Bush. The nation in the past has been our firmest friend is becoming instead our foremost enemy. As the U.S. government discovers that it can threaten and attack other nations with impunity, it will surely soon begin to threaten countries that have been numbered among its allies. As its insatiable demand for resources prompts ever bolder colonial adventures, it will come to interfere directly with strategic interests of other quasi-imperial states. As it refuses to take responsibilities for the consequences of the use of those resources, it threatens the rest of the world with environmental disaster. It has become openly contemptuous of other governments and prepared to dispose of any treaty or agreement that impedes its strategic objectives. The U.S., in other words, behaves like any other imperial power. Imperial powers expand their empires until they meet with overwhelming resistance. For Britain to abandon the special relationship would be to accept that this is happening. To accept that the U.S. presents a danger to the rest of the world would be to acknowledge the need to resist it. Resisting the U.S. would be the most daring reversal of a policy the British government has undertaken for more than 60 years. We can resist the U.S. neither by military nor economic means, but we can resist it diplomatically. The only safe and sensible response to American power is a policy of non-cooperation. Britain and the rest of Europe should impede, at the diplomatic level, all U.S. attempts to act unilaterally. We should launch independent efforts to resolve the Iraq crisis and the Middle East conflict. And we should cross our fingers and hope that a combination of economic mismanagement, gangster capitalism, and excessive military spending will reduce America's power to the extent that it ceases to use the rest of the world as its doormat. Only when the U.S. can accept its role as a nation whose interests must be balanced with those of all other nations can we resume a friendship that is once, if briefly, founded upon the principles of justice. End of quote. The foregoing sentiment seems to be spreading amongst the nations of the world as they watch the United States run amok. This wanton disregard by Bush and his cronies for the 6 billion people of the world who live outside of the U.S. is coming to rankle those 6 billion. The article says it all. What can I add? The question hanging in the background here is where Canada will stand when the nations of this world finally stand up against the American Empire. Would Chrétien have the parts to join them? Would Paul Martin? Harsh criticism. One of the reasons I feel free to criticize the United States of America is that I used to be a citizen of that benighted country. But Canada took me in when I was looking for a new home, and I am grateful to my new country for giving me that chance. If I am harsh with Canada at times, it is because I love not just what Canada is, but what it could be, could have become, if it had not been sold out by the likes of Chrétien and Mulroney. There is another reason why I am critical of the Bush regime. It needs it. The Olympics. Vancouver Whistler has been put on the shortlist for sites for the Olympics in the winter of 2010. Whoopee! Why did we need another circus here in BC? We haven't finished paying for Expo 86, Vanderzam's Edigo trip. I've written the following letter to the International Olympic Committee under the alias that I was born with. 28 August 2002, the International Olympic Committee, blah, 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 Switzerland. Vancouver bid for the 2010 Winter Olympics. Dear Sirs, I am writing as a citizen of British Columbia who lives outside of the Vancouver-Whistler area. I believe that a majority of us in the hinterlands join many in the Vancouver area in opposing the proposal to hold the 2010 Winter Olympic Games in British Columbia. We have a new government in this province which cut taxes immediately upon taking office. They have subsequently fired civil servants and reduced services to our citizens, pleading a lack of resources. My community of Prince George, located in the center of the province, has seen the closing of some half dozen public schools this year due to cuts in resources allocated by the province. There has been a restructuring of our BC medical system, resulting in the closing of several hospitals completely and the reduction of services and beds in others. The government is abandoning some of our parks, a precious heritage we had hoped to pass on to our children. Services across the board are being eliminated or turned over to for-profit corporations. This government of British Columbia is no longer willing or able to fund adequately its current responsibilities to our citizens, much less take on an unlimited obligation to cover any commitments made by others. These games and their cost would be used as an excuse to further penalize the citizens of this province. According to your website, the City of Vancouver and Municipality of Whistler have pledged to, quote, provide government services including security, customs, and immigration at no cost, unquote, to your organization. Furthermore, you state that the Government of British Columbia has agreed to indemnify the City of Vancouver and the Resort Municipality of Whistler against any costs arising from commitments and obligations they made related to the bid. If Vancouver Whistler should be selected as the venue for the 2010 Winter Olympics, all the citizens of our province would suffer from the channeling of our remaining financial resources into building infrastructure and providing services to these games. According to media reports, this government proposes to spend over $300 million to support these games. I have heard that the provincial government has promised to improve the only direct road, Highway 99, between North Vancouver and Whistler. I have driven this road many times, as some of you may have also. In long stretches, it is carved into the side of a vertical rock face. It is winding and treacherous at the best of times. The promise of the government to alleviate the dangers on this road are specious. Without moving entire mountains, this road cannot be other than narrow and winding. This is and will remain one of the most dangerous roadways in Canada. Adding winter traffic on this road due to the Olympics would be reckless in the extreme. I beg you to consider these factors and reject the bid of British Columbia for your Winter Games in favor of a venue where the impacts on local citizens will not be so severe. Sincerely yours, blah, blah, blah. There's another thing I did not mention in the letter. Unless we are confident that we will have won the so-called War on Terror soon, why in the world do we want to sponsor an event that would become a magnet for terrorists? Expect a successful bid to cost one hell of a lot more than estimated for security alone. This is certainly a fancy project for a province that cannot afford to educate its children. It sounds definitely third world to me. Quislings. The word Quisling has been a part of the English language for over 50 years now. Vidkun Quisling was a Norwegian army officer who served as their Minister of Defense from 1931 to 1933. He met with Adolf Hitler in 1939 to urge a German invasion and occupation of Norway. When the Germans did invade Norway, Quisling collaborated with the Nazis in ruling the country. After the liberation of Norway in May 1945, he was tried and executed as a traitor. What does this have to do with Canada in the 21st century? Read the papers. Our very own defense minister, John McCallum, is engaged in negotiating a deal that would allow the United States forces to enter Canada in the event of a terrorist attack. According to the Globe and Mail, McCallum assures critics that this deal will just build upon current deals to collaborate with U.S. air forces, and the new one will include land and sea troops. Right, betrayal of sovereignty by degrees is all right now. On the surface, this sounds like a nice neighborly agreement between friends. If my house catches fire, you will help me put it out, right? But suppose we don't perceive a fire and they come in with their fire department anyway. What does Trojan horse mean to you? The Yanks already created a command called NORTHCOM that is supposed to protect North America. All of North America. Now just suppose that the Americans perceive a threat where we don't. Will they help us when we don't want help? Suppose a future Canadian government invited North Korean ships to visit Prince Rupert or some such unlikely event. That's our sovereign right if we see fit. Now, if the Yanks were still having their snit over North Korean independence and saw their navy as a threat, could they invoke such an agreement as permission to use physical force to expel them? It sounds far-fetched, but not out of bounds of what they have done before and are planning for the future. Recall that they are planning an invasion of Iraq based on an irrelevant Security Council resolution from 1991. Minister of Defense McCallum assures us that this deal would only be invoked at the invitation of the Canadian government. Now take a look at the American track record on this. In Vietnam, the Americans refused to allow the election scheduled to take place in 1966 in the North and South. This is a matter of fact. They set up a puppet government in the South which declared that part of Vietnam to be a separate country, contrary to the peace accords of 1964. That puppet government then invited the Americans to invade and fight a war that ended up killing 3.5 million Vietnamese and destroying most of the country's infrastructure. Suppose a future Canadian government did not follow orders from the American masters. Would it be beyond them to select some disaffected group, the Canadian Alliance comes to mind, and recognize them as a government in exile that would then invite the Americans in to defend Canada from itself? Any reason why someone like Bush would not do that? Michael Byers, a Canadian teaching international law at Duke University in the state, said that it would be a foolish Canadian government that went into any kind of closer military cooperation without specifying out in exhaustive detail the legal protections of Canadians' interest. Amen. Remember that Bush has a very flexible definition of terrorism. If you are not with us, you are against us, he has said. No room there for reasoned neutrality. And Bush has redefined prisoner of war to allow himself the power to avoid the obligations of the Geneva Conventions on the treatment of prisoners of war. He has even declared that, as the Commander-in-Chief of the American Armed Forces, he has the right to detain American citizens without charge or access to legal counsel. No, the Americans cannot be trusted to abide with the spirit of such an agreement with Canada. It would be filed away in a drawer to be used at their discretion whenever they pleased to give a gloss of legality to any actions they would care to take in Canada in the future. Quisling was the Minister of Defense in Norway. McCallum is Minister of Defense in Canada. Quisling invited Hitler to invade Norway. McCallum has invited Bush to send his army into Canada. Quisling was tried for treason and executed. Canada has abolished capital punishment, so I cannot take the analogy any further. You figure it out. Pride Days. Pride Days have come and gone, and a good time was had by all. The crowds were thin for the parade this year, as a steady rain dampened things a bit. But a lot of people braved the rain and enjoyed the entertainment and good feelings in Fort George Park. If you missed some of the show this year, don't miss it next. This is not just about sexual orientation, as some would have you believe. It's about diversity and the appreciation of alternative lifestyles. Although there was a dispute over the wording of a proclamation by City Council, this was just a sideshow to the theme of celebration of pride and diversity. Sexual orientation. The Pride Days this year were sponsored by gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered community. This is not as inclusive as you would first think. One of the oddest characters I knew in the Army was a guy who described himself as pansexual. He claimed that he could develop a sexual caring relationship with anything, animal, vegetable, or mineral. I was never able to verify this claim. His name was Kellogg, and his nickname was Crash, since everything he drove was destined to be involved in an accident. The Army, in its wisdom, chose to make him a driver of military taxis. Crash was one of the soldiers who prided themselves in piloting the fleet of 57 Chevys without using their clutches. They would just drop into neutral, estimate the revs required, then jam into the next gear. No problem. The taxpayers paid for the repairs. Crash Kellogg owned an old 1938 Chevy for a while. Word came to the barracks that the military police had found Crash on one of the remoter roads to our base with the side of his car crumpled and scraped. When questioned, he said that it fell over and became damaged. This was a neat trick on a straight stretch of road. Just before the police arrived, he commandeered some local Panamanians who put the car back on its wheels. He could organize anyone to do anything. Crash had two admirers, a couple of Panamanian men named Gogi and Carlos. These two guys followed Crash like puppies. Gogi and Carlos must have had some pull, as they had access to our military base with their car. Crash exploited them mercilessly. One day he conned them into taking him to a cat house in Panama City, providing him with money, and then waiting while he cavorted with the whores. I seriously wonder if Crash is still alive. I doubt it. In a way, the world is poorer when we lose people like Crash who exist on the cutting edge of strangeness. Firefighters. There was a report recently that the International Association of Firefighters voted to boycott a ceremony on the 6th of October that will honor American firefighters who died in the line of duty, including those at the World Trade Center. It seems that George Bush is supposed to speak there and weep over their fallen brothers. It also came out that this same George Bush recently vetoed a bill that would have provided $340 million to fund fire departments in the United States. A spokesman for the firefighters in Virginia was quoted as saying, "The president has merely been using firefighters and their families as one big photo opportunity. We will work actively to not grant him another photo op with us." I look forward to hearing more about this one in the future. I suspect that the Bush regime will find some way to buy off these very angry firefighters. Watch this one. Mussolini. There was a front page photo in the Globe and Mail the other day of Mussolini, the late fascist dictator of Italy, who gave the democracies a spot of trouble back in the 30s and 40s. Long reviled as one of history's nastier mass murderers and all-around sons of bitches, his image is immortalized in a massive mural in the Church of the Madonna della Difesa. In this mural, he is seated on horseback, a hero amidst an admiring throng of saints, prophets, bishops, angels, and such ilk. Don't pack your bag and dig up your passport to see this heroic depiction of Il Duce. It is in Montreal. Now the Italian community there is pressing to have this church, with its fascist memorial, declared a national historical monument. None other than Sheila Copps, our heritage minister, declared it a living monument. Why was this bastard immortalized on Canadian soil? Well, it seems that in 1929, Mussolini signed the Lateran Pact, which created the Vatican City-State. This allowed the church hierarchy to sit comfortably in their little patch of land and ignore the Second World War and all the damage that their boy Mussolini and his friend Adolf were doing to the millions of Europeans who were killed, wounded, and displaced in those fateful years. Whoopee and praise the Lord! I'm no admirer of fascist dictators, past, present, or, may the gods help us, future. I do not want to see my government grant official recognition to a tribute to such a brute as this Mussolini. What in hell is wrong with our government? That is a rhetorical question. Anecdote. After a dose of Mussolini, it's time to lighten up again. An image that comes to my mind occasionally defines some of the perennial problems of developing countries. 30 years ago, I drove from Kathmandu to Istanbul with some people in a Volkswagen van. What else? This was at a time when one could actually traverse Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and other places that I would not want to revisit now. Like many travelers, I hung out in Kathmandu for a few weeks, enjoying the legal grass and soaking up the atmosphere. This was not all fun and trekking for me, as I was recovering from a bout of hepatitis that I picked up in Indonesia. In those days, we called it hippie-titis, as it was difficult to avoid if one ate the local food. While killing time in Nepal, I wrote lots of letters, real letters. In those days, Nepal was really isolated. There were infrequent flights to Kathmandu, but no telephone or radio contact with the outside world. Mail was the way to communicate. And mailing a letter was not a matter of dropping a stamped envelope in a letterbox. One had to go to the main post office and watch while an employee canceled your stamp and dropped the letter in the outgoing bag. A letter left with an uncancelled stamp stood a good chance of being stolen so that the stamp could be regummed and resold. A lot of people in that country earned less than the price of a stamp for a day's work. One day I found myself in the post office immersed in a scene from Dante. Perhaps 100 local citizens pushed, shoved, and shouted while trying to get service at one of two wickets. I say perhaps 100 since these folks were jammed together in such a wad that all individuality seemed to be lost. In this bedlam, there were a few frustrated hippies who took matters into their own hands. With shouts and gestures, they organized all of those locals into two orderly lines in front of the two windows, and then they went to the back of the lines. For a half hour or so, the lines progressed, and finally the hippies were served and they left. Immediately, the lines collapsed, and the previous bedlam was resumed. This helped affirm my conclusion that chaos was the way things worked, or more often did not work, in that part of the world. A friend recently returned from a trip to India, a country that he has come to love. It is a great country if you have money, but a hell of a place to be poor. Anyway, he told me that the Indians had recently constructed a modern divided highway between two major cities. He traveled on this road, and he reported that the police were unable to convince the populace that each side of the boulevard was for travel in one direction. Each side was a mass of pedestrians, ox carts, overloaded trucks, bicycles, rickshaws, and such, all going every which way and pushing into any opening. Instead of the former road of chaos, they now had two parallel chaotic roads. Until there is a change of mindset in these countries, I suppose they will be immersed in inefficiency and underdevelopment. Now, when we drove across the border from Nepal to India, we had spent our last Nepalese currency, and none of the seven of us had Indian rupees. India had strict rules about black market currency exchange. These laws were enforced like other laws there. A law there meant that a person violating that law had to pay off someone, and then they could carry on with impunity. We decided that one of us would cash a traveler's check, which we could all draw upon until we found a money changer who would give us more than the official rate. We stopped at a bank that looked much like an older Western bank with the imposing columns and stone facade. Inside it was different. There were vast numbers of employees, all talking and drinking tea. There was barely room to turn around as the place was full of the bicycles of these employees. It was apparent that a bicycle and an unattended outside would be stripped or stolen immediately. And then there were the records. A number of huge metal containers, similar to our dumpsters, stood around overflowing with huge ledgers that looked like wallpaper sample books. Into this mess we strode with our traveler's check. It took time to convince someone behind a wicket to pay attention to us and find someone who spoke English. We were directed to another wicket where the performance was repeated. Someone looked at the check and the owner's passport. Notations were made on official forms. Papers were stamped. We were directed to another wicket. More papers. More stamps. Somewhere along the line, a frustrated official asked us why we were bothering them with this check instead of finding a money changer who would change our check with no hassles. When we told him that we wanted to do this exchange legally, he totally failed to understand such a motivation. As I recall, it was a couple of hours before we finally emerged from the bank with our rupees. From then on, we dealt with the ubiquitous money changers on the streets. Resources. For anyone interested in following up on any of the things I rant about on these programs, a good place to start is in the library of the Prince George Public Interest Research Group at UNBC. All students in the university are automatically members of PIRG, and you students should have no hesitation about dropping in and checking out their resources and activities. The public is also invited to come in for a visit. This organization, inspired by Ralph Nader's original PIRG in the States, is for everyone. One of the publications PIRG has on hand is the CCPA Monitor, put out by the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. The CCPA is at the opposite end of the political spectrum from the Fraser Institute, if that gives you an idea of their stance on society. An article from the latest Monitor that I was just reading is entitled, "In the Dusk of the Dying Oil Age, the Elites Still Fail Us." The article opens with the following. To understand the major political, economic, and military events of recent times, it is important to understand that most of them have had their roots in the planet's dwindling oil supplies. We are nearing the end of the oil age. Our civilization is almost entirely based on the use of hydrocarbons from oil and natural gas to operate our transportation systems, heat our homes, run our technologies, and provide the plastics from which most of our consumer goods are made. It goes on to the following. Bush's arrogance knows no bounds. When asked at a press conference what he would do if Canada were to limit its oil and gas exports to the States, Bush replied that he would, quote, do whatever is necessary to protect our right to Canada's oil and gas. My emphasis, how is that for arrogance? It is expected that world oil production will peak between 2020 and 2040. When the oil production ceases to meet world demand, history will change drastically. If you want to read further on this issue, check out the Monitor in the PIRG library. More on oil. As the Monitor article said, we are facing world oil shortages in the near future. Thanks to Brian Mulroney, the infamous Canadian trader, we now have guaranteed the Americans access to our oil and gas for as long as they last. In the NAFTA, Mulroney signed away our right to restrict exports of hydrocarbon energy regardless of our own needs. This foreshadows the day when we Canadians will freeze in the dark while our energy is flowing south to feed the SUVs in Los Angeles. The next chapter of this treason is the giving away of our electricity resources to foreign corporations so the Canadians will have to bid against Californians for access to their own electricity. If we are not willing to pay American rates with depreciated Canadian dollars for this electricity, the private corporations will just sell itself. And that's free enterprise when teamed up with free trade. Love that freedom, don't we? That does it for Uncle Don Reads the Comics for today for September. Tune in at 11:30 a.m. next Wednesday morning to hear my take on the anniversary of Osama bin Laden's American Urban Renewal Project and the repercussions therefrom. This is CFUR at 88.7 in Prince George. Stay tuned for exciting programming. I guess that will take care of the little bastards for another week.